Exploring our oceans before it's too late.
Exploring the world has been critical to our survival since the beginning of time, and then sharing knowledge about how the world works. But we somehow stopped, and we have this misimpression that we've explored everything on Earth, and so now we just have to go out and explore space. Well, that's crazy. I mean, first of all, space doesn't sustain life. Our little planet does, and we have to know how it does that so that we can protect it.
That's deep sea explorer Edith Witter. We talk with her about Below the Edge of Darkness, a memoir of exploring light and life in the deep sea. Then we revisit our 2017 interview with Cy Montgomery about the book she co-authored, Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Fireflies do it. So does the tiny bristlemouth fish and the appropriately named stoplight fish, along with countless other denizens of our deep oceans. Produce light, that is, or bioluminescence. My guest, Edith Witter, is one of the world's leading experts on the phenomenon of marine bioluminescence. She was also the first person to get moving images of the legendary giant squid. In her thrilling memoir, Below the Edge of Darkness, Witter describes the wonders of the deep ocean as she pursues her questions about one of the most important and widely used forms of communication in nature. In the process, she reveals hidden worlds and a dazzling menagerie of behaviors and animals, from microbes to leviathans. Below the Edge of Darkness urges us to pay attention to what we are learning about this least explored part of Earth's biosphere before it's too late. And I just want to thank you, Edith Witter, for coming on to Writer's Voice.
I'm so happy to be here.
This book, Below the Edge of Darkness, I told you before we began recording that this is about a world, the deep, dark ocean, Below the Edge of Darkness, that I really knew almost nothing about. And it's about bioluminescence. You are one of the world's leading researchers on bioluminescence. Just so all our listeners are on the same page, tell us, what is bioluminescence?
Bioluminescence is cold chemical light. Usually people are familiar with fireflies. They produce one type of bioluminescence. It's just that the chemicals that are used to produce the light are made by the animals themselves, but different animals make different chemicals. So it's a rather remarkable fact that there are so many animals in the ocean that make light, and so few people know about it.
And how important is it in the evolutionary scheme of things?
It's probably hugely important. So it's thought that the Cambrian explosion may have been triggered by the evolution of eyes, and then followed by that would have been the evolution of bioluminescence, because as the ocean filled up with ever nastier and swifter predators, animals had to either evolve to outswim those predators or find a way to hide. But there's no trees or bushes to hide behind. So the only thing they could do was go down into the dark depths to hide. And that was a problem because all the food from photosynthesis occurs at the surface. And so they ended up evolving this remarkable lifestyle that is responsible for the most massive animal migration pattern on the planet. Every day in oceans around the world, animals dive down into the depths when the sun comes up to hide. And then as the sun sets, they race to the surface where the food was manufactured in order to eat.
And I mean, what kind of a distance are we talking about? Of course, it depends on where you are, but, you know, just average.
Well, sunlight can penetrate as deep as 1,000 meters, over 3,000 feet, 3,300 feet. But that is a ridiculously long distance for some of these pretty small animals to have to migrate. And so they often try to limit the distance they have to go by producing the smallest possible silhouette, having silver sides. So fish are flat and have silver sides. That's not a hydrodynamic thing to be flat. If you want to be a fast swimmer, you're big and round like a tuna or a shark. And then they take it one step further and they produce light from their bellies that exactly matches the color and the intensity of downwelling sunlight. So it's a perfect cloaking device, and it allows them not to have to swim as far as they might otherwise in order to be able to hide.
And when you say it matches, does that mean it changes as the sunlight changes as well?
Exactly right. So if a cloud goes over the sun and dims the sunlight, they have to dim their light somehow. It's truly a remarkable adaptation.
So that's not the only purpose of light, is lighting up your silhouette to evade predators. What are some of the other purposes of bioluminescence?
So all of these animals that live below the edge of darkness are having to do all the things that animals do on land. They have to find food and attract mates and defend against predators. And so bioluminescence plays a role in all of those. So a lot of animals find food because they have built-in flashlights on their faces near their eye to be able to see in the darkness. Many of them have built-in luminescent lures, like that scary-looking anglerfish in Finding Nemo. A lot of them have specially shaped light organs that are different in the males and the females, or different flash patterns in order to be able to attract a mate. And then they use bioluminescence for defense in a whole variety of different ways, not just as camouflage, which is what I was describing earlier, but a lot of them can actually squirt their luminescent chemicals out into the water to blind a predator that's attacking them so that they can make an escape into the darkness. There's shrimp that can spew bioluminescence out of their mouths like a fire-breathing dragon. There's fish. One type is called the shining tube shoulder because it actually shoots light out of a tube on its shoulder. There's squid that can do this, that actually shoot out something that looks like photon torpedoes. I mean, it's just astonishing the number of ways these animals use light.
You have a wonderful picture I found of the shrimp, a shrimp shooting out that bioluminescence as it's being attacked by, I think it was an anglerfish. Is that right?
It was actually a viperfish, if it's the picture I'm thinking of.
A viperfish, that's it. Yeah, these are incredible creatures that you find. But I'd like to go, before we go further into this exploration of the Below the Edge of Darkness, which is the title of your book, Edith Witter, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about yourself and how you got into this, because you have written that your obsession with bioluminescence grew out of your brush with blindness. So tell us about that. What's the connection?
Well, I had decided I wanted to be a marine biologist pretty early in life. And when I started in college, that was the path I was on. But during my college physical, I mentioned a pain down my left leg that was bothering me. And they did an x-ray and discovered that my back was broken, which probably was due to all the trees I jumped out of as a kid. I always had low back pain. I thought everybody did. Anyway, it got worse and worse. And my second semester at Tufts, I finally had to go and have something done about it. So I went in for a spinal fusion and it went very wrong. And I ended up hemorrhaging into both my eyes. And so when I came to, I was blind, and I remained blind in my left eye for almost a year. And my right eye, I started to get vision back after a few months. And it obviously made me a lot more conscious of the miracle of vision and how we see things. I would see light and dark, but I couldn't make any sense of what I was seeing because there was so much blood in my eyes. And so it just started me thinking a lot more about this whole thing of vision and the difference between detecting light and actually being able to resolve an image. And I think that came back to me in many ways as I went on with my career. And it certainly influenced how I thought about what these animals must be using for information when they live in this world that is predominantly dark, but see just swirling flashes of light every now and then. That's very much what my life was like for a little while.
And how do you feel? How did it influence?
Well, I think I spent a lot of my time in submersibles sitting there just thinking about what life must be like for animals and what kind of cues they must have to be able to use. And I could envision what it's like not to be able to see or just see a flash of light and try to make sense of it. And I think it had a pretty profound influence on just how much I was able to put myself in that environment and think more about what that means, what that visual environment means for their survival.
Yeah, in fact, you write in this book, in Below the Edge of Darkness, that we need a bigger picture of what makes life possible. Is that some of what you're talking about here?
Oh, that's definitely true. It's just incredible that right now, as far as we know, this is the only rock in the universe that can sustain life. And we don't know how it's done, but we know the ocean plays a huge role in it. And probably the reason we're still here, despite our mismanagement of resources, is because the oceans have buffered us for so long. But we're beginning to overwhelm even the ocean now. And that has very worrying implications.
Yes, and that's actually something I want to return to a little bit later because it's absolutely critical. And it's a lot of the reason that you wrote this book, in fact, is to as an alarm for all of us about how much there is that we don't know and are absolutely dependent on. But what I wanted to then go on is talk a little bit more about some of the creatures that you have encountered. You know, for example, the stoplight fish, which just sounds so amazing. Talk about that fish.
Yeah, so they're called stoplight fish because not only do they have the blue light organ that is so typical of most animals that have a built-in flashlight, but they also have a red one. And that's very unusual. Most animals in the ocean can only see blue light. And they only make blue light because that's the color that travels furthest through seawater. So if you're evolving a communication channel, blue light makes sense. But these stoplight fish also can produce red light and they can see red light. So they can use it like a sniper scope to be able to sneak up on animals that are blind to their red light and be able to see without being seen.
And then there's the Earth's most abundant vertebrate, the bristlemouth fish.
Yeah, the little bent-toothed bristlemouth. It's, you know, a very tiny, unassuming little fish, but its belly is covered with light organs that help it to camouflage itself. And it's probably the most abundant vertebrate on the planet. We're talking about quadrillions of fish that can make bioluminescence. So you could make a case for bioluminescence being possibly the most common form of communication on the planet. And yet, once again, something that most people know nothing about.
Yes, communication. So hiding, communication, and seeing, those would be the three major purposes of bioluminescence. Have I left anything out?
Well, that yes. I mean, and then using it for defense and for attracting mates.
Edith Witter, you were on the expedition that first got moving images of the giant squid. What an incredible creature, talking about amazing creatures. Tell us about that expedition and tell us about the giant squid.
Well, the giant squid, called the Kraken by some, was a monster of myth for a very long time. Sailors would talk about this creature that they'd seen that could be mistaken for an island when seen floating at the surface and was purported to be able to pull men and ships to watery graves. But for a long time, science didn't really accept that those stories. They just sound like fishermen's tales. But then in 1860s, off the Canary Islands, a French warship came across one of these creatures. It was dying at the surface, and they fired some cannon shot at it to try to finish it off. And then they wrapped a line around it to try to bring it back. They drew pictures of what it looked like. And the line actually cut through the animal. It was so heavy. And the head and the arms fell back into the sea, but they were able to bring the mantle, the big tail section, back. And finally, the science community accepted that these stories of the Kraken were actually squid. I mean, they knew what small squid looked like, and this was obviously an enormous squid. In fact, so enormous that with its tentacles fully extended, it was virtually as tall as a four-story building. And it was just absolutely amazing that there was this creature that we knew existed in our deep oceans, and yet we'd never managed to film it in its natural habitat. So it became kind of the holy grail of natural history cinematography to get that footage. And there were many expeditions mounted and many giant squid hunters that devoted their careers to hunting down the giant squid without success. I got invited on the 2012 expedition, which was off Japan, because of the work I had been doing imitating certain bioluminescent displays that turned out to be very attractive to large squid. And so the hope was that my approach using this lure and red light, like the stoplight fish uses to see without being seen, would be a way to be able to bring animals into the range of the camera, specifically the giant squid.
And so what happened?
It worked. The very first time we put the camera system, which I called the Medusa, down with the optical lure on it, the first time we put it down without the lure, and we saw almost nothing in the water, which was kind of alarming. But then we put it down with the optical lure, which we called the electronic jellyfish, because the bioluminescent display it was imitating was that of a common deep sea jellyfish. And we recorded a giant squid for the very first time, waving its arms in front of the camera lens. I mean, we didn't actually see the whole squid until several deployments later, when we saw one come in and attack, and we were able to see the whole thing. And it was just amazing. And eventually we actually saw it from the submersible that we were diving from and got high resolution video of this creature of mythology. And it was so different than any of us expected, because the dead specimens are red. And this was looked like it was carved out of metal.
Yeah, you said it goes back and forth between bronze and silver?
Yeah, brushed aluminum. It really looked like it was carved out of metal. It was just such an alien beast. And yet we were able to film it for 23 minutes. So that was such a coup.
Do you think, I mean, octopuses are extremely intelligent. Are squid also?
Yeah, they seem to be very intelligent creatures.
So what do you think it might have thought when it clamped down on this electronic jellyfish and didn't get anything that was actually edible?
Well, actually, when they respond to the jellyfish, it's because it's what's known as a bioluminescent burglar alarm. So the idea is that it works defensively for the jellyfish, because when it gets attacked by something, it puts on this incredibly showy and bright display that illuminates whatever's attacking them and making it visible to its predators. And so the squid isn't attacking the jellyfish directly. It's trying to find whatever's attacking the jellyfish as a potential source of food for it.
Hmm. And you say, you write in the book that this was in a part of the ocean that in fact had very little life. How can the giant squid survive?
Well, that's actually something that really perturbed me when we were first seeing the video and diving in the submersible. There was almost nothing there. But my camera was launched off the back of the ship and just drifted for a day or two before we would collect it. And then we had a satellite beacon on it so we could go find it. And it would always drift north toward the Curacao current, which is like the Gulf Stream. And so I think there were eddies spinning off of that major river in the ocean, and there was a lot of rich life in those. And we actually got to dive in one of them eventually, and it was full of life. And so I think that's what was happening.
And are those ocean currents being disrupted the way the Gulf Stream is by climate change?
Yeah, all of the ocean currents are at risk now because of climate change. And that's a really scary scenario because the stability of our climate has been largely attributed to these thermohaline circulation patterns that stabilized climate 10,000 years ago and made agriculture possible. And if we lose that stability and you don't even know when winter is going to show up anymore, I mean, all of these things could have such a disruptive effect that life could become very, very difficult on what was once practically the Garden of Eden.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with oceanographer Edith Witter about her memoir, Below the Edge of Darkness. Now, you also went on an expedition to Cuba. How did that happen?
That was in 1997. That was the first time I went on an expedition that was entirely funded by television. So it was Discovery Channel that put that together. And Al Giddings, who did the underwater cinematography for Titanic and a lot of other famous movies, had a personal relationship with Fidel Castro. And so based on that, they managed to get permits to bring the first oceanographic vessel into Cuban waters since Castro came to power. And we had this deep diving expedition around the island. And it was incredibly wonderful to be able to see the island in such an unusual way. We got to go to ashore a lot, visit with the Cuban people. But it was not good science. They just were always trying to look for the next shot and move on. And so we didn't really get much science done.
And you met Fidel, which I also have met Fidel Castro a lot earlier than you did.
Oh, my.
You were quite surprised by him, but in your description, I was not at all surprised. You experienced his intense intellectual curiosity. Tell us a little bit about your conversation with him and what he asked you about.
Yeah, so my colleague and I had positioned ourselves along the path he would be taking into the galley of the ship, and I was just going to video him. And when he walked past us, he stopped to chat with us. And he was asking questions about, first of all, you know, what were we doing on the ship? And I talked about looking at these animals that live in a world without sunlight and yet produce light to help them survive. And he segued from that into why don't they freeze, which didn't make sense to me initially. And then I realized what he was curious about was, if there's no sunlight, why doesn't it freeze down there? Which is a really smart question. And there were just a series of smart questions. And he clearly had read quite a lot and was concerned about the impact of climate change on island nations. He talked about the Maldives and how they might be impacted by climate change. And then he talked about tuna migration patterns. It was a pretty impressive, lengthy conversation. And I was very pleased at the end of it to discover that I had the whole thing on tape, because when I dropped the video camera to my side, I hadn't turned it off. And the whole time it was pointing straight up. So the entire conversation, I was pointing at the inside of the dictator's nose.
Well, that's great. Now, let's go to what's going on with the oceans, because you are very involved in trying to change that. You have an organization, the Ocean Research and Conservation Association, otherwise known as ORCA. Talk about, I mean, we know climate change is acidifying the oceans, but also talk about things like trawling and plastics.
Yeah, bottom trawling is just such a terrible assault on life in the ocean. So seeing it from a submersible, it's just heart-wrenching, because what happens is you have these magnificent undersea gardens full of deep sea corals and just magnificent forms of life. And the bottom trawlers drag these nets across the bottom that have rollers in front of them that cause the bottom dwelling fish and shrimp to jump up into the net, but they just decimate this undersea garden and turn it into a moonscape that won't be able to sustain life for hundreds of years. So it's incredibly short-sighted, and it's all going on out of sight and out of mind. And at the same time that we're pulling out every last fish, shrimp, and squid, we're filling the oceans with our plastics and our pollutants to just absolutely horrible effect. And then we now have yet another oil spill off of California. Deep sea drilling has done a lot of damage and will continue to do so. And we're on the brink of a new gold rush with bottom mining for deep sea metals like silver and gold, copper, nickel, zinc. But they're going to do enormous damage. They're even talking about mining some of the vent sites, which are unique environments that may have actually been the origins of life on Earth. We hardly know anything about them, and we're going to just be decimating them. It makes no sense that we're destroying the ocean before we've even explored what's in it.
And what can be done? I mean, is anything being done to stop that now that has some teeth?
It's all about raising awareness and making people understand how much our lives on this planet depend on the ocean. And, you know, human beings are by nature explorers. It's in all of us. The first time a baby crawls away from the safety of its mother's arms to see what's around that corner, they're exploring their world. Exploring the world has been critical to our survival since the beginning of time. And then sharing knowledge about how the world works. But we somehow stopped. And we have this misimpression that we've explored everything on Earth. And so now we just have to go out and explore space. Well, that's crazy. I mean, first of all, space doesn't sustain life. Our little planet does. And we have to know how it does that so that we can protect it.
This must be gut-wrenching for you.
It truly is. But I do try to encourage people to be optimistic, because I think that all of the doom and gloom is just causing people to shut down, and they close their eyes and their ears. They don't want to hear it anymore. And what we need to do is appeal to our better instincts and our best instincts as explorers.
Well, Edith Witter, your book, Below the Edge of Darkness, is a huge step forward. It's a compelling story, a memoir of exploring light and life in the deep sea. It's got a whole lot of amazing, you're a great raconteur, let's just put it that way.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. That's music to my ears.
And I love all the little asides at the bottom of the page, too. They're really funny. They're great. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you for having me.
Edith Witter is an oceanographer, marine biologist, and the co-founder, CEO, and senior scientist at the Ocean Research and Conservation Association, or ORCA, a nonprofit organization dedicated to saving the ocean. You can read an excerpt from Below the Edge of Darkness at writersvoice.net, and you can also find her TED Talk there about finding the giant squid. Next up, we revisit our 2017 interview with Cy Montgomery about the book she co-authored, Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find great content there, including web-only features like links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio or Twitter at Writer's Voice. Also, Instagram at Writer's Voice Podcast. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on your podcast app. It really helps others to find the show. In 2017, we spoke with Cy Montgomery, famed author of The Soul of an Octopus, about a collection of essays she and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas wrote, Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. Let's listen to that now. Did you know that many animals have names for the humans they know, or that they laugh? Some of them even rock out to our music. Some lions settle down to watch the sunset every night and roar when it dips below the horizon. These and many other examples in the new book, Tamed and Untamed, by Cy Montgomery and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, show the depth of animal thought and feeling. Actually, I should say the other animals, because, of course, we are animals too. And this is exactly what Montgomery and Thomas point out in the essays penned by them that they've gathered together for the book Tamed and Untamed. Drawing on stories of animals both wild and domestic, as diverse as snails, house cats, hawks, sharks, dogs, lions, and octopuses, the book shows that the more we learn about what other animals think and feel, the more we understand ourselves as animals too. Cy Montgomery is the author of many books for adults and children, including The Soul of an Octopus and The Good Good Pig. Her co-author, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, is one of the most widely read authors on anthropology and animals, both wild and domestic. Her many books include Dreaming of Lions and The Hidden Life of Dogs. Well, Cy Montgomery, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm delighted to be on. Thank you.
I missed a chance to talk with you about your acclaimed book, The Soul of the Octopus, so I was so glad when this new book came across my transom, the book that you co-wrote with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who we've also interviewed, this book, Tamed and Untamed. First of all, just tell us, how did this work come about and why?
Well, Elizabeth Marshall Thomas and I have been best friends for 32 years last month. We met when I had moved to New Hampshire, having lived for 6 months in a tent in the outback studying emus. And my husband and I knew no one. He saw an article in the newspaper about this really cool lady who lived the next town over, who had worked with Katie Payne to discover infrasound in elephants. The fact that elephants can communicate over vast distances using sounds that we can't hear. And he said, you know, you should meet this person. Well, I had a column at the time in a newspaper called New Hampshire Times. And so I had a good excuse to call her up and interview her. I went over to her house and instantly we realized that despite a considerable age difference and despite the fact that she was magnificently accomplished and I was just starting my career, that we were really kindred spirits. She was already, when in the 50s, before I was walking, much less reading, she was already a finalist for the National Book Award for her amazing book of living with the sand bushmen in Namibia called The Harmless People. But when I first interviewed her, I didn't know that about her. I just knew about the connection with elephants. And I had been to Africa on research expeditions before, and we just had so much to talk about. And ever since then, she's been my first reader on everything I've written. I've been her first reader on everything she's written. She has written forewords for my stuff. I have written blurbs for her stuff. She's blurbed my things. We're in each other's books. She's a major character in one of my nationally best-selling books, The Good Good Pig. And we just had never written a book together. This book is a collection of essays that we have written individually, but they're together for the first time in book form. And it's such a wonderful thing to have this out and have our names next to each other on the cover.
That's a great story. And this book, you know, the essays in it are all directed towards one very important purpose, and that is to get human beings to climb down off our pedestal and realize something about the creatures that we share this world with. What is that?
Well, that is that animals think, feel, and know. Animals even have senses that we have, in Henry Beston's words, lost or never attained. And they deserve our affection and our respect and our compassion. And, you know, you totally got it when you said, you know, it's time to climb off our pedestal. It's not even a good or fun place to live on a pedestal. It's so much better to be embedded in a family, which is really what we are with the other animals. You look at fish, you know, we are basically, says Dilbert, fish plus time. There's a wonderful book by Neil Shubin that is called Your Inner Fish. I mean, and think of the mammals. I mean, all placental mammals share 90% of our DNA. We really are a family, and I think it's, and Liz agrees, that it's not just foolish, but dangerous for us to pretend that we're not embedded in this family.
Dangerous?
Well, take a look at what we've done to the earth. It's like, oh, people against animals. I'll just throw pollution in the ocean because it's just going to kill a bunch of whales and fish. So what? Well, guess what? We end up eating all of that. By 2050, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish.
Oh.
And there was recently a report showing that pollution of all kinds is, it kills more people every year around the world than AIDS and tuberculosis and malaria combined.
Wow.
And we used to think pollution was just something that, you know, wasn't good for the fish, or it wasn't good if some seal got caught in it, or it made birds' eggshells thin, and gee, that was too bad, but we had to do progress. Well, what's not good for the natural world isn't good for us either.
Yeah, you also talk about this mindset of anthropodenial, about the universality of consciousness. And this wonderful book, Tamed and Untamed, is really about the kinds of consciousness that we share with other animals. Some remarkable stories, which we'll get to very soon. But first, I want to ask you, what kind of evidence? I mean, you have studied many, many animals. You've been around people who do the studying of those animals. What is the evidence that animals have consciousness? And, you know, to me, this is like a no-brainer. But
right.
Yeah.
Right. If you have a dog or a cat or even a fish who you pay any attention to, you know they do. But there's tons of, well, first we should talk about consciousness itself, because consciousness is a construct. It is not necessarily something that can be measured by a device to see if it's there or not. We all think we are conscious, but there are philosophers and scientists who say that the idea of consciousness is a fiction. But if we set that aside, if we decide, okay, I have consciousness, consciousness is a thing, what are some of its components? Well, again, scientists and philosophers and neurologists, neuroscientists disagree, but on some things they do agree, and that is, can you learn? Can you remember? Is there evidence of intelligence? Is there a mind there? Now, when we're asleep, we are not conscious, but your mind is still there. So you can still keep splitting hairs ad infinitum. But one piece of evidence, one of the many pieces of evidence that I find extremely compelling for consciousness, if we're going to say consciousness is definitely something humans have, if you look at the neurochemical basis of our emotions, for example, you can see spikes in certain hormones and neurotransmitters during certain emotional states. Oxytocin is one of them, the cuddle hormone that it's called. And it's a hormone that helps us to bond with our children and our mates and groups of people and other species who we love. Well, you look in almost any organism. In fact, any organism that has been tested has a version of that neurochemical, which is responsible for something that we hold very dear and consider to be an important part of what it means to be human and what it means to be conscious. And even octopuses, who, unlike humans, don't give live birth, they lay eggs. Unlike humans, don't suckle their young, and oxytocin is considered to also be responsible for milk letdown. Yet they have a hormone so like oxytocin, they call it cephalotocin for cephalopods. And every other one of those neurotransmitters that's associated with brain states that we experience as humans has been found in other critters. And I get that information from Dr. Jennifer Mather, who has a great phrase that you can just say when people want to argue with you. You can say, well, neurotransmitters are highly conserved across taxa. That usually shuts people up.
Hi, what is it? Neurotransmitters are highly conserved across taxa?
Yeah, isn't that great?
I love it. That's not taxa reform, is it?
Boy, that is very funny. Taxa reform. That's a really good thing, good joke for my biologist friends.
So what you're saying is that basically we all share these chemicals that are chemicals that were evolved to be connected with emotions.
That's right. That's right. And there was actually in 2012 a convention of neuroscientists, neurobiologists, folks who study the brain, and they signed essentially a declaration. It was called the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness. And they said, and it was a ton of luminaries who signed this thing, they said that the neural substrate necessary to generate consciousness is present in all mammals and birds and probably in cephalopods as well, specifically octopuses.
And insects, no?
Boy, I don't know if insects were in there. They are invertebrates. Mm-hmm. So little is known about insects. I mean, when you think that there are still people out there saying that, you know, rats' lives don't matter, they don't have feeling, they don't have emotions, you can subject them to any kind of torture in a laboratory. There's still folks saying that. No wonder people haven't looked into the intellectual experiences of insects because, you know, a bug, people think nothing of squashing a bug. And not all bugs, most bugs are what we consider, you know, insects are actually beneficial to us. But people think, oh, it's a nuisance, let's just kill it. Liz Thomas makes the point that, you know, we look up in the sky and we see this magnificent eagle. Well, if it were as tiny as a bug, we'd swat it.
That's a good point. And about rats, by the way, you know, you say that they're as smart and as affectionate as dogs. I had an experience where, this is several years ago, a friend of my son's had a rat, and then he couldn't take care of it anymore. It had a huge abscess. The poor thing was really just, you know, weeks from the end of its life. But we took it in. And it was just astonishing. I didn't know just how affectionate these creatures are, how responsive it was to us. It clearly understood that we were trying to ease its pain, you know, and I'd like to think we gave it a more, you know, it kind of came to us as at the hospice stage, but I like to think we eased its transition into another form of existence. But
I'm sure you did. Not many people would do that. You're very special.
Well, I just was so struck by how clearly this rat had intelligence. You say rats actually understand words.
Oh, they totally understand words. I mean, tons of animals understand words. They totally understand words. They laugh. We don't hear their laughter, but like elephant infrasound, it's at a frequency we don't hear. They laugh under the same circumstances we do. They laugh when they're tickled. Rats make an appearance in a couple of essays in Tamed and Untamed, and in one of them, we briefly see a rat's dream. Because when rats run mazes, you can put electrodes on their heads and see, you know, specific patterns that occur when they are turning left on this part of the maze, running over here, walking over there. And when they dream about the same stuff we do. They dream about their daily lives and the things that they have to consolidate in their memories. And so during this experiment, researchers found that rats were dreaming of running the maze. And they could even see, by comparing those patterns, they were identical to the patterns that they got when the animal was awake and running the maze.
Wow. You know, another thing that you say, Cy Montgomery, in this book that you co-authored with Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, Tamed and Untamed, is that we name animals, of course, but that animals also name us.
Yes, I think this is so exciting. It's so cool. I actually originally began to think about this issue thanks to Melissa Cowie, who has written a great book called How to Speak Chicken. Well, I met her at a AAAS meeting, American Association for the Advancement of Science, and we were both getting awards for our books. And her previous book was also about chickens. And I have a flock who appear in the book several times. And she started telling me that when she walks into their coop, they make a vocalization unlike any that she had ever heard in any other flock, and they only do it at the moment that they see her. Well, we figured it out. That's their name for her. And they aren't the only animals who use proper names. We know for a fact, for instance, that dolphins have signature whistles to identify each other. And Liz, who has studied wolves on Baffin Island, says that wolves' howls also identify each caller.
Well, you know, it just occurred to me this makes so much sense because our animals recognize our names for them. If they didn't have names for us, I mean, they wouldn't even have the concept of a proper name to understand our names for them.
Right. I think that makes complete sense.
Now, you also say, you know, I mean, we're just talking about the things that animals are that we have in common with them. Of course, they're far more skilled than we in many ways as well. But something was very interesting. You talk about how animals, like, for example, bears, use plants as medicines.
Oh, yeah. There was a real interesting article I was reading showing that even insects use plants as medicines. There's a lot of animals. It was documented in chimpanzees, for example. It's been known in sheep. We don't think of sheep as being really smart, but when they start getting something wrong with their stomachs, they go and they eat a specific type of plant. And, you know, how do they know to do this? It probably the same way that we do, by experimenting, or maybe by watching others. And it's been claimed by Native Americans for many years that the original medicine woman or medicine man was a bear, which means that they learned from watching bears what medicines are good. And boy, were they smart, as we know. Bears will methodically strip the bark from willow trees and chew that up. And there's no nutrition in the willow tree, but what's in the bark is salicylic acid, which is the same molecule that is making aspirin an effective pain reliever and something that takes down inflammation. So they know that.
Now, there are some other anecdotes or stories, because these are a series of, you know, short vignettes in Tamed and Untamed, that point up the aesthetic appreciation, the aesthetic qualities of animals. And I'd like to talk about two of them. One is Snowball the cockatoo, because after I read about Snowball, I went and watched the video online.
Oh, wasn't that awesome? God, if you're having a bad day, folks, just watch this video and you will smile ear to ear. Didn't you love it?
Yeah, and what joy.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, they experience joy just like we do, and we often can see it. Mm-hmm. But there's times when we can't see it because we haven't learned how to look. But boy, Snowball certainly makes it obvious that he's having a blast.
So tell our listeners about Snowball.
Well, Snowball is a cockatoo who a family couldn't keep for an interest. There's an interesting reason behind that. Anyway, he fell in love with the young girl who adopted him, and when she went off to college, he assumed that she'd been eaten by an owl because, you know, if your mate doesn't come back, it's because somebody ate them. They really do mate for life, unlike humans. And then when she came back, he was so furious at her for leaving that he would attack her. Mm. So he got dropped off at Bird Lovers Only Bird Rescue, and he came with a CD. Well, Bird Lovers Only gets a lot of rescued animals, and they have a very busy day there. So Irina Schultz, who runs the rescue, didn't have a chance to play the CD right away. But when she did and saw what Snowball did, she completely went crazy. He rocked out to this CD. It was the Backstreet Boys singing their song Everybody. And he raised his crest. He marched on his feet. He threw his head around. He opened and closed his wings, and he screamed and he sang. But he also did it in time to the music. Then this struck Irina Schultz, who's actually a scientist herself, as something worthy of investigation. And so Ani Patel, who wrote a beautiful book called Music in the Brain, he's a neuroscientist now at Tufts, went to see if birds actually do have this cognitive ability, which is usually ascribed to higher minds, called beat perception and synchronization. We understand the beat to music, and we can synchronize with it, so much so that you almost can't help tapping your feet sometimes to a good tune. But other animals were thought to not have this because it was a property, it was thought, of so-called higher minds. But parrots certainly have it. He has documented this in a ton of other parrots. He has had people just kind of score their videoed dancing behavior and then comparing it to the music later, and found that they have an excellent way of anticipating that next beat. It's a very sophisticated cognitive ability when you think of it, because you have to not only perceive but anticipate that there is a beat. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever danced with a lousy dancer, you realize that not all humans have it so great.
You have to discern patterns.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And birds are very sophisticated at this. And interestingly, I mean, Ani says that this may be a characteristic of vocal learning, the kind of characteristic that allows us, for example, to use language. And language, for the longest time, was thought to be one of the many Rubicons people keep devising to keep animals and humans separated. But it turns out we're not separate from animals. We both enjoy dancing. I spent my birthday 1 year rocking out with Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo. I picked a song, and we danced to it together, and it was so much fun. He really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And I started picking up his lead. You know, when you're dancing, I don't know if other people are old enough to remember, for example, ballroom dancing in mm-hmm. which the male partner is supposed to lead. Well, I learned that kind of dancing as well as a more modern dancing. But even when you're doing modern dancing in which partners don't touch, often you do pick up your partner's lead. And I realized I was picking up Snowball's. And I realized this not just from what I felt, but Irina's husband videotaped me dancing with Snowball. And later, I could see with the music turned off that I was indeed following his lead.
That's wonderful. Now, speaking of aesthetics, there's another really beautiful story in the book that you tell about lions. You mentioned Katie Payne, who discovered that infrasound, is that what you called it?
Elephant communication. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She also... Well, she had a number of remarkable experiences with lions, but the one I'd like you to talk to us about is about the lion in the sunset.
Oh, well, this was actually something that Liz wrote about and Liz observed. Liz observed a lion roaring at the very moment that the sun sank beneath the horizon. And the lion had been lying there watching the sun sink. So it meant something to that lion to be seeing the sun, and it meant something when it disappeared beneath the horizon. The lion had some kind of an emotional response to that. And I think that many animals perceive beauty, including beauty that we don't appreciate. I mean, dogs, for example, can encounter a big pile of excrement and think that's just great, and we fail to appreciate it. But animals may appreciate some of the same kinds of beauty, visual beauty, oral beauty, the beauty of a lovely smell that we do as well.
What was also interesting about the lion in the sunset is, and yes, this was an essay by Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, was that it was peculiar to this community of lions, the Etosha lions. It wasn't just this lion. Other lions in that community also would watch the sunset and roar, but other lions don't. So this is kind of a layered observation, not just appreciation of beauty, but a cultural value.
Yeah, absolutely. Animals do have culture, and this has been documented over and over and over. The same species does not behave the same way in different places, just like humans.
My next question is funny. I was looking it over, and I realized there might even be kind of a bias in it. But here we go. You wrote The Soul of an Octopus, and one of the octopi that you write about in the book is Octavia, who also appears in this book, Tamed and Untamed. And I wanted to ask you, this was my question, what did Octavia teach you about intelligence that could be seen as to be equal to our own? So I do want you to answer that, but I also realize that there's kind of a bias in it, which is that other animals who aren't like dolphins or whales or octopi or parrots, maybe their intelligence is no really less than our own. It's just different.
Yeah, I think you are so right. That is so on the ball. Liz and I frequently see animals' intelligence compared to that of children, for example. People have said, you know, a pig is as smart as a 3-year-old child or something like this. And that just really demeans animals. Mm-hmm. An octopus can't do all the stuff that a 3-year-old child can do intellectually. But, as one other researcher pointed out, if you lop off that child's arm, how many colors can it turn in half a second? And can it go out and hunt and capture something to eat? No, of course not. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not something that you can really compare. So much of an animal's intelligence is there so the animal can do its job in the world. And our jobs in the world often entail things like, constructing buildings, writing books, driving a car. And you would not want your dog or pig or octopus at least driving a car. and they don't want to either. But can I taste with my skin? No. There's only one piece of my skin I can taste with, and that is my tongue, and I can't taste nearly as much about the world as an octopus can. Can I pour my body through a tiny opening the size of an orange? No, but a 100-pound octopus can. There's so many things that they can do that we can't, and there are many things that we can do that they can't. But what struck me the most about the octopus's intelligence and how it is like ours is that they can look up through the water and recognize me as an individual with, I presume, thoughts and feelings, an individual who they choose to come over and visit with and play with.
And also trick.
That's right. They can deceive. Boy, are they good at deceiving. But yeah, Octavia totally tricked a whole crowd of people. This was right after she came, actually. She'd only been at the aquarium a few weeks, and I had only interacted with her once before. And I went with a group of folks with Living on Earth, an environmental radio show here in Boston. They wanted to do a piece on octopus intelligence. So we took them behind the scenes at the New England Aquarium. Bill Murphy, the senior aquarist, opened up Octavia's tank. And she came over and was playing with us. We were feeding her fish. We were petting her. We were letting her suck on us. We were just lost in the sensation of watching her change color and shape and what she felt like. And then we thought, you know what, it would be fun to give her another fish. And we looked around. The bucket was gone. And with all these people standing around, most of them touching her, she had managed to steal that bucket right from out from under our noses. And I think she was just laughing. Interestingly, she didn't even seem to want the fish in it. She just was playing with the bucket.
That's so amazing. And hiding it, you said.
Yes, she hid it underneath her. It's easy for her to hide things. They have an interbrachial web between their arms, right. Almost like an umbrella, and they can hide stuff under there.
So
she was a riot. God, she was a lovely, lovely octopus. She had a sense of humor, I think. So did Kali, another octopus that I knew. They're so distinctive. You know, there's folks that will say, oh, you're anthropomorphizing, that octopus didn't recognize you, didn't know you. Not true, because Roland Anderson and Jennifer Mather did studies at Seattle Aquarium with octopuses, and they dressed people in identical outfits, and half the people had a bristly stick, half the people had a delicious fish. And the octopuses very quickly got to recognize, just by looking up through the water at them, not even by touching or tasting the people, which ones had brought them the delicious fish and which ones had touched them with the bristly stick. And how do we know? Because they would advance happily to meet the people who had the delicious fish, even if they left the delicious fish at home. They were happy to see those people, even if they weren't carrying the item. And those who had touched them with the bristly stick, they would move away, they would do camouflage behaviors around their eyes, and some of them would blast those people in the face with icy cold salt water.
Wow.
Yeah. So they do recognize individual people. And when you think of this, and how hard it is for many people to recognize individual animals, we don't have our eyes on yet to recognize differences. But if you look carefully, you're going to see them, and they will eventually become obvious.
So do you think that this awareness of the animal consciousness, you know, co-equal with us, and there are people who say that trees also have consciousness.
Oh, yeah, example. There's a fabulous new book out called The Hidden Life of Trees, which is fantastic. And it talks about the wood wide web, how trees communicate, and they do communicate through the mycelia of fungi and transmit information just like our internet.
So do you think that this message is getting out? Do you see a shift in our consciousness about it?
Yes, I definitely do. I mean, our politics have yet to catch up with that. Our laws have yet to catch up with much of it. But there is a huge change that I've seen just in my lifetime, and that Liz has seen even more so. She's 86. I am 59. She's seen an even bigger change. But we kind of have it in us to realize this, you know, because until, evolutionarily speaking, quite recently, we were hunter-gatherers, and you had to pay attention to nature, or you would find nothing to eat, or someone would come and eat you. And when we were hunter-gatherers, and when Liz was in Namibia studying the Bushmen, no one questioned that animals had thoughts and feelings and made plans and decisions and cared about their lives.
Right. Well, Cy Montgomery, it has just been such a joy to speak with you about this wonderful book that you co-authored, really a collection of vignettes that you and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas have written and put now together, Tamed and Untamed. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Cy Montgomery talking to Writer's Voice in 2017 about Tamed and Untamed, the collection of essays she and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas wrote. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Stan Cox about his book, The Path to a Livable Future, A New Politics to Fight Climate Change, Racism, and the Next Pandemic. Also, Leonard Rubinstein tells us about his book, Perilous Medicine, The Struggle to Protect Healthcare from the Violence of War. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.